Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to episode 17 of Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and me, your host, Petros Patsalivas. If you haven't listened to this podcast before, I intend to shake every branch of the Coppola family tree to answer the fateful question, are they the greatest film family of all time? I do that by watching all of their collective filmographies and getting a guest each week to join me and help me answer that question. This week's guest is from all the way over in Australia. It is the fantastic Tristan Burrell from Double Impact, which is fantastic. They take this kind of deep look at films from their collective childhoods, and I guess if you're a millennial, it will be yours as well. So they've covered some fantastic things such as Space Jam, Goodfellas, Labyrinth, Bowfinger. There's a whole host of stuff that they've covered. They're always churning out really great stuff. They've got this fantastic dynamic, the two of them. So I was absolutely thrilled to invite Tristan on the podcast to talk about a film that may or may not be that good, but you'll have to listen and find out exactly what me and Tristan thought about it. Again, there is no Patreon exclusive content. The time zones worked out. It was getting late for Tristan, so there's no Patreon content for this episode. However, if you would like to support the podcast anyway, you can do so by heading over to patreon.com/cagedinpod. All that money really does help kind of keep the lights on over here at Caged In Towers. So please, as is always the case, we do not leave any tomb unchecked. We do not leave any vampire unstaked, any head cut off in regards to spoilers. So if you haven't seen this film, please be sure to check out a handy document in the show notes that will tell you if and where this film is streaming. It's an open source document as well. So if you live in another country or if you spot anything that needs to be added to the list, feel free to go on and do it. So I assume if you're with us, you've seen the film, or you do not care for spoilers. So all that's left to do is to garner a reputation where you have a terrible nickname like Vlad the Impaler, make a pact with an ancient vampire who dwells in a cave, and suck some blood as we make some Coppola connections. Today's film is Dracula Untold, directed by Gary Shaw, written by Matt Zazamar and Burke Sharpless. Those names don't sound real. Starring Luke Evans, Dominic Cooper, and most importantly, the director of photography on this film, it's this week's Coppola Connection, John Schwartzman. To tackle this film, I don't just need mystical vampire superpowers and a little bit of help. So I've enlisted one half of the Double Impact podcast, Tristan Burrell, to help me figure out why Vlad the Impaler is painted out to be such a nice guy. How are you, Tristan?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm excited. I'm I want to say I'm excited about talking about this film, but I may have made a massive mistake by watching Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula before watching this yesterday.
It's an interesting point of contrast, isn't it? I feel like it's my fault. I chose this movie. But I would also say, without giving it all away just yet, I was like somewhat pleasantly surprised. I had very low expectations. But I chose it because when I go on other people's podcasts, because our podcast is so focused on 80s and 90s with a skew towards the Jean-Claude Van Damme's of the world, I try and choose something as far away as possible, and this felt like something different. But yeah, I did not have high hopes at all.
I think one of the earliest things I read was this was supposed to like kick off a kind of MCU-style universe, and then realized there's no other films in that universe. I was like, this is
It's the on-again, off-again Dark Universe thing. Because you had Tom Cruise's The Mummy. I think I, Frankenstein might have been part of that. I think they were going to... There's that cast photo, and it's got like Johnny Depp's in there. I think he was going to be the Invisible Man. And it's on again, off again. It's like it's off, but then someone will make an Invisible Man movie. Remember that one that came out, the Blumhouse one came out?
Yeah.
And it did well, so they're like, well, maybe we should still do it. Let's keep going. And so it keeps – I think this one was supposed to be sort of the Iron Man of the bunch with that ending of let the games begin.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
We'll get to that ending. We'll definitely get to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Before we do, though, I wanted to talk about Dracula and, like, vampires in general and kind of your relation to it. Are you a fan of the Dracula story?
I would say I'm a fan, but a relatively passive fan. So I should caveat this entire episode by saying I'm by no means a Dracula expert. Most of what drove my decision is what I said is you know, getting as far away from the movies we typically cover as possible. In saying that, I was trying to think what is my most, I guess, consumed Dracula-related content. And I realized Count Duckula. Do you remember Count Duckula?
Yeah.
Castle Dracula, home for many centuries to a dreadful dynasty of vicious vampire ducks, the Counts of Dracula. Legend has it that these foul beings can be destroyed by a stake through the heart or exposure to sunlight. This does not suffice, however, for they may be brought back to life by means of a secret rite that can be performed once a century when the moon is in the eighth house of Aquarius.
Blood.
I'll get it.
The latest reincarnation did not run according to plan.
And actually, I watched it every day. Like, this is great speaking to an Englishman because, you know, when we have American guests or even some Australians, they've never heard of it. But that show is the best. I loved it. It's so bizarre. I also just watched the theme song to it just before we started chatting because I wanted to refresh myself. It's batshit crazy. It's so bizarre that exists.
In the heart of Transylvania, in the Vampire Hall of Fame, yeah, there's not a vampire in any other. He won't fight Beast the Man, cause he's a bad guy, yeah, and things never run blood. If you're looking for some fun, you can always count upon the one and one they call
Dracula.
Hey, Count Dracula.
I remember that, and I've recently been watching Darkwing Duck with my son. Do you remember that? It's like it's like a duck PI.
Darkwing Duck. Yeah. Oh man, what a time to grow up. The other, I do really, really like Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. You know, including Keanu Reeves to a degree. But I think part of me choosing this film was also the fact that I couldn't do that film. So this would also be an excuse to kind of talk about that a little bit. But I watched that probably just at the right time. I didn't watch it when it came out, but I watched it maybe 10 years ago or so. And it was just such a strange cultural artifact because it was made, what, mid-90s or something. But it was all practical effects, and it gave it this strange, timeless character to it.
What's really interesting about that film is it's kind of got this like revisionist take on it. Like I've noticed recently, especially on like online, there's loads of people like going like, it's a masterpiece. And I'm like, is it? Like, do you know what I mean? Like I thought like, especially around that time, like Coppola was considered like a fucking joke. Do you know what I mean? And then like, and obviously
this for after years, Jack, people,
people have like said like Keanu Reeves's accent is egregious, like Winona Ryder's shit, but it's just so great. It's just high camp and like everyone it is. Looks exactly. like having so much fun.
Exactly. It's like, it is high camp. It's like melodrama and it's just, it's almost a bit soap opera-y. But then it does also hit you in the feels a bit. And yeah, all the practical effects and that kind of thing. I hope I'm not just saying this with a nostalgic lens, but I do genuinely like it triggers something in my brain that makes me, it hits on a different level. It's a special movie, I think.
Well, yeah, you look at the cast as well. And like, I'll be obviously doing a full episode on it, but like, I was watching it yesterday going like, right, so we've got Gary Oldman, Keanu Reeves, Winona Ryder. And it's like, oh, it's Tom Waits as Renfield. It's like Richard E. Grant. You've got like Sir Anthony Hopkins. It's like people just keep coming and coming, like Sadie Frost. And you're like, fucking hell, this is like, this is great. Like, this is like so, and it's fun. And it paints, and we'll get into this in the way that Dracula is portrayed. But like,
That
one, they make him like this kind of like, I don't know, he's slightly romantic, conflicted character where he's like, you can kind of understand why he is the way he is. Like, whereas this film, we'll get into the kind of portrayal of Dracula.
Well, I actually went back and watched the beginning of, because I watched it like 10 years ago or so, like I mentioned, but I haven't watched it since. And so I rewatched the beginning of it today just because I couldn't remember to what extent they painted him as sympathetic in the opening. And it was a nice refresher because, it's quite different to this film, which we'll get into. But now I just want to watch the whole thing now. I'll probably watch it this weekend.
Well, this film is very much like it could have been called Dracula Begins. It's very much got
100%.
We're going to pull out an origin story basically from that first scene you get of Francis Ford Coppola's film. Like, it's like, how can we stretch out that like death of the wife becoming the monster like tale?
100%. And this movie came and went without me ever really noticing. And so I never really saw the trailer. I mean, maybe I saw it back in the day, but never left an impression on me. So I didn't really know what to expect. I won't go into all the details now. But one thing was that I didn't realize, I mean, if it was called Dracula Begins, that would have set the right expectation. But I was like, it's a great first act. And then the whole film was still just the origin story. And I really wasn't expecting that. But you're right. It's a very... very of the time thing, I think, the mid 2010s. It's kind of got this flavor of Game of Thrones meets Batman Begins meets something like Maleficent or Wicked, you know, taking these classic villains and making them sympathetic with all of those pieces, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it just puts it very firmly in 2014.
Well, I found a list online which talks about the kind of best adaptations and worst adaptations of Dracula.
Oh, yeah.
That are out there. And I think like this is, a top five of each. And this is like number three on the list. Like people consider this a real stinker, whereas like Francis Ford Coppola's like is considered one of the best.
Count Duckula is probably number one.
I think another one of the best is like the Christopher Lee 1979.
Oh, wow. I never even...
And then obviously the original Bela Lugosi 1931 is like the high watermark of kind of the Dracula story.
I saw that one popping up a lot too. And the only ones I could remember, which I then went and watched the trailers for, was Dracula 2000. I went and had a look at. It's so 2000. You know, there was a few movies with the 2000 on the end of the name. They're the most 2000 thing that ever 2000. It's like Dracula in modern day. And I'm so glad this movie didn't start there. And the other one was Dracula Dead and Loving It with Leslie Nielsen. Yeah. Which I didn't realize was a Mel Brooks film, which makes it even more disappointing. Maybe it's good. I don't think I ever watched it. But
I think it's a heavy pastiche on the Francis Ford Coppola film. So like it takes a lot of its cues.
That probably came soon after.
That.
Yeah.
So before we talk about Dracula Untold, I always like to ask my guests a few questions to kind of see what their Coppola credentials are. So when did you first become aware of the Coppola family as this kind of, I like to say, like this entity, that they were this spider's web of a family?
I think the web has only really become obvious to me in the last few years. So obviously Francis Ford Coppola was the first one I became aware of for obvious reasons. But even him, like I didn't watch The Godfather for a long time, to the point where I was almost saving it. I'm similar with music. When there's an artist everyone tells me I will like, I'll just be like, all right, I'll get to it. I want it to be like a good, especially with a movie, you want it to be a perfect viewing and all that kind of stuff. So I was kind of saving it. So I was relatively late to the party even with Francis Ford Coppola. But then went pretty quickly through a few. I still haven't seen all of them. I guess I've seen Jack. Jack might have been the first one I saw. Just thinking of realities of when I grew up.
Yeah. Same here. Like, I laugh. Yeah. But yeah.
And Apocalypse Now, which feels more like my kind of thing than the Godfather, is one of those ones I respect and appreciate, but I'd probably more quickly go and rewatch Apocalypse Now. And then Sofia Coppola, my wife, actually, back when she was my girlfriend, was a big fan of Marie Antoinette film. And I was I'd totally been dismissive of it, and she showed it to me. I was like, interesting. I assume that was before I watched Lost in Translation. So I became aware that there were at least two of them at this point. And then I think it was when I realized Nicolas Cage was a Coppola that everything started to unlock, you know. My mind expanded.
It's
and then
when
Jason Schwartzman
That's the mad one. I think it was only like a couple of years ago I found out that Talia Shire was Jason Schwartzman's mum. And I was
I still don't really understand the family tree. I tried to look it up today and it's still a bit confusing.
Yeah, so it's like Jason Schwartzman's mum is Adrian from the Rocky films, which is just like, that's absolutely batshit crazy. And then like you've got
I didn't realize she was a Coppola. That's crazy. Yeah. And see, so I winced a little bit when you said my Coppola credentials, because I'm a little rusty. To the point where when I chose this movie, I thought it said Jason Schwartzman next to it, not John Schwartzman. And so I thought he was going to be in this movie. And then I got to the end and I was like, wait a second, where was Jason Schwartzman? And then John Schwartzman popped up in the credits and I was like, oh, cinematography, of course. And so he's Jason Schwartzman's brother, right?
Yeah. He's like...
Yeah, okay.
And he's one who's in there for like, he's like a half brother. So like, technically like his mum isn't Talia Shire. So some people could say like, I shouldn't...
okay.
I shouldn't be covering his films, but I always think he's probably been to the Coppola like family estate for Christmas.
100%. So I've grown up with half siblings. I'm a half sibling myself. I would hate to be not considered a part of my own family. He's 100% exactly. A Coppola.
Yeah, I think when I saw like a quote from Nick Cage talking about working with him on The Rock as like a cousin, I was he's on the list. We'll have him on the list.
And Cage is, I'm sure you've covered this before, but Cage is a Coppola. Like, he's just changed his last name, right? That's his like a straight up Coppola.
Yeah. Nicholas Kim Coppola. Yeah, dad is Francis Ford Coppola's brother.
And did he just change his name just to create a bit of space for himself?
Yeah. Well, it's always that really funny thing because people go like, he's carved out his own niche. He changed his name. And it's like, yeah.
Still your family.
And if you look at his early filmography, it's like his second ever film is Rumblefish, which is a Francis Ford Coppola film. And he's in like a handful of Francis Ford Coppola films early on. It's like, you can't like be like, I'm distancing myself from the family and then go, uncle, please, can I be in your film? There with the begging bowl.
The name it's like, no, I just wanted to change the perception that there was any kind of involved.
I want to benefit from nepotism. I don't want people to realize that it's nepotism.
Yeah. Or to people even to think that I want to benefit from nepotism. That's pretty funny.
Amazing. So what would have been, this is kind of probably going to be a bit hard because you don't tend to look out for cinematographers, but like,
yeah.
Do you know what would have been the first John Swartzman film you would have seen?
Well, I had to look it up because you're right. I think I feel this is the type of thing that always makes I got a movie podcast and I don't know shit about cinematography or cinematographers. and so I had to educate myself a little bit. And I was surprised of what I learned with John Swartzman. So this guy is a Michael Bay guy. Like,
yeah.
I think almost all of the Michael Bay movies, and he credits himself with coming up with that Bruckheimer, Michael Bay aesthetic. Mm-hmm. So he's quite influential. I had no idea who he was and what he'd worked on. And I think I looked at all the full list. I think technically probably the first one I would have seen was Airheads.
Oh, amazing.
Remember that? Brendan Fraser. I mean, I'm not going to say the cinematography of that film really took my breath away, but I mean that's the kind of movie that we need to rewatch on my podcast. But I haven't really, it didn't leave a lasting impression on me, that one. But then I think the next one was probably Armageddon.
Oh, absolute gem.
Yeah, and I haven't watched that since I was a kid either. So. And that was just purely looking at the chronology of all these things. And I assume they were probably the first ones I saw. But, it kind of blew my mind that he kind of regards himself as the guy that cemented that Michael Bay aesthetic, which is of significance. And I've got to tell you before we get into it in detail, but I've got to tell you, this movie I thought looked pretty slick before I even knew we were watching it because of the cinematography. I was like, this is a good-looking movie.
Well, that's the thing. He kind of seems like a bit of like an undersung hero in regards to like cinematography, because there are certain ones out there that like people go, Roger Deakins, do you know what I mean? Like kind of like Blade Runner 49, the 2049 and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like kind of, or like Wally Pfister. Tends to be the people who work with like your Christopher Nolans and stuff like that get shouted about. But like somebody like John Swartzman, he seems to be a bit of like a journeyman, do you know what I mean? He will just do like loads and loads of films. And then like, even if you look at those, especially those two Michael Bay films from the 90s, kind of the biggest hits, The Rock and Armageddon.
Yeah.
Two films that are in the Criterion collection, which fucking blows my mind that like, do you know what I mean? This kind of club of like, like mustache twirling have gone, we're going to have two Michael Bay films, please. Like, and the fact that, he is instrumental in kind of getting that aesthetic that as jingoistic and flag waving as it is, it's kind of like,
yeah,
it's still got a big hook to it.
And you can see when he does the non-Michael Bay stuff, like this movie and like Jurassic World and a bunch of other things, that he does it. He has a few different gears. He doesn't have to turn it all the way up to Bay levels. Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, again, I'm no expert in cinematography or cinematographers, but I imagine it's almost like, you know, there's some songwriters that are quite famous, and then there's some songwriters that you've never heard their names before. Or maybe even more like those character actors where you see them in a bunch of things but you never know their names. It's mm-hmm. kind of like that, but even more so because it's behind the scenes. But he's made pretty stuff in front of all of our eyes, and a lot of us never noticed who he was.
So let's talk about Dracula Untold.
I have been waiting an eternity for a man of your strength. But what kind of man crawls into his own grave in search of hope?
A desperate one. The Turks threaten to destroy my kingdom. They're almost here. I want the power to save my people. Save my family.
Your salvation is in the dark. And all its power.
Welcome to your life.
You will have the strength of 100 men.
There's no turning back.
And dominion over the night and all its creatures.
At what price?
You have no idea. But I'm going to show you. Drink.
What's happening to you?
I chose this.
But why?
Men do not fear swords.
He is coming.
They fear monsters.
This is not who you are.
Do you think you are alive? Because you can fight! You are alive because of what I did to save you!
The world.
Never forget who I am.
So when...
Yes.
When did you first see this? Is this a first time watch for you?
I watched it for the first time yesterday. I was very skeptical. I remember because I think I Frankenstein came out the same year, and I remember seeing these posters. I was living in New York at the time, and I remember seeing the posters on the subway and thinking, that looks like fucking trash. especially I Frankenstein. I think for that one I had seen the trailer, and I think it was a little bit more like, it's Frankenstein, but he's ripped and it's the modern day and he's a bit of a superhero. It's like, oh, God. And I kind of just put this one in the same bucket. So I was kind of expecting like, oh, it's Dracula, but he's ripped and he's in the present day and he's doing things. But it wasn't that, which was a pleasant surprise. But, yeah, I knew nothing of this. And I guess also maybe one softer push into why I chose this one was I've recently realized I like Luke Evans.
Mm-hmm.
I'd kind of dismissed him, maybe because of this movie. I'd kind of dismissed him for a long time. And then when he was cast as Gaston in the Beauty and the Beast, not that I'm a huge Beauty and the Beast fan, but my wife is, and just the fact that he can sing, just like a switch went in my brain where I'm like, oh, he's interesting. I just didn't expect that. And then I think I saw him on James Corden doing some singing and things, and I was like, you're an interesting guy, Luke Evans. I'm listening. So I was keen to just see, what he brought to this. But, yeah, outside of those two elements, I knew nothing of this film.
There's that thing around this time you had, like you mentioned, I, Frankenstein. I think one that really jumps out to me is that Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. That came out. I'm not sure if you remember. I'm like, they all kind of have this same aesthetic where it's like,
yeah,
really dark and dreary, and it's like moody and broody and sexy.
Yeah,
and it's kind of got like a superhero edge to it, and it's a bit like, I was working at a cinema when this came out, and I remember like going like, not legit, like free tickets, all I wanted to see films, and this was what I just went, hard pass, please. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is, doesn't
exactly. No, I would not, I wouldn't, man, I wouldn't have ever watched this movie, I don't think, for this podcast. But it's interesting too, because I was thinking, as you said that, like in the 90s, we had Bram Stoker's Dracula, and then we had Mary Shelley's Frankenstein as well by, what's his name? And,
Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah. And it's almost, and they were of a similar, what was it, I guess, of the time. But it's almost like you could kind of go back through history and get a sense of what the decade was like by looking at how they adapted Frankenstein and Dracula.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because the 2000s one, is again, is extremely 2000s. Yeah, so it was a mystery to me.
Do you mind giving us a synopsis of this film?
All right, I'll do my darndest. So, 15th century in Romania, Pennsylvania, and we got Vlad the Impaler, which I believe we can try dive more into that, but which I believe is a new element in terms of it being officially Vlad the Impaler, who becomes, well, AKA is already known as sort of Vlad Dracula. This is one of my questions about Dracula that I'm a little vague on, but he's Vlad the Impaler, prince of Wallachia and Transylvania. The Ottoman are the bad guys. Turkish, I believe. Is, when they say Turks, that sounds like a racial slur. Am I allowed to say
Turks? Yeah, I was thinking that. And I'm half Greek, and they've got a big like beef with the Turkish. But even I was a bit like, I think you call them the Turks.
I don't think I can say that. Yeah. So the Turkish people were wonderful people. they had a disagreement, and there was tension. In this particular scenario, I guess a bunch of scout troops with the Turkish army had disappeared. Vlad and co. found some evidence of some kind of foul play and traced it back to a vampire in a cave up on a hill. Needless to say, the Turkish army was not over the moon about their troops going missing. Assumed it was Vlad the Impaler. I don't know why, maybe something to do with his name, Vlad the Impaler. War ensues. The head of the Turkish army wants to take 1,000 boys from Transylvania, including the son of Vlad. He realizes he needs to step up his game a bit if he's going to beat these guys. He doesn't want to give up the kids, and so he goes and revisits that vampire in a cave and gets, I guess, a free trial of what it's like to be a vampire. This was a new element, I think, right? About that. But he gets one of those, you know, sometimes when you sign up for a new piece of software or Netflix, you sign up for Netflix, you get 7 days free. He got, vampires do this too, apparently. But it's for 3 days. And the catch is he's going to crave human blood. As long as he doesn't indulge, he'll revert back to normal after 3 days. But if he consumes human blood, he will be a vampire forever. He ends up defeating the entire army almost by himself. His wife dies. He avenges her by drinking her blood and becoming a full-blown vampire, infecting his whole village, and then they go and unleash on the army, yada, 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 yada. He wins. He kills all the vampires, including himself, which was an interesting twist. And then we get the old tacked on ending of, wait, but he's actually alive and now he's in the present. So it was, look, I feel like I maybe put different weightings on different parts of the plot there, but that's in a nutshell kind of what went down. I'm sure we can talk about different elements of that in a bit more detail. But I think the thing for me was, I was not expecting the plot that I just went through, except for the present day stuff, feels like it is the first act. It should be the first act of the film.
And yeah.
I want to see the rest of these adventures. And it's not like it was a super long film either. It was 90 minutes. Like
it
could have been 2 and a bit hours and stretched it out a bit. But anyway, that's the plot.
There was a moment it got to. I think it's before they have like the final showdown where everybody's vamped up and kind of like all going for blood. Where I was a bit like, "Is this it?" Like that's what
exactly.
Dawned on me. It's like, "This is it." Like we're not like
same.
And I realized we've only really been introduced to Vlad the Impaler, his wife, kind of like. I couldn't tell you, like, without looking it up, I couldn't tell you what the character's name was. And, like, we get all these, like, tertiary characters, whether it's these kind of right-hand men and stuff like that. And I'm like, when one of them dies, I think it gets, like, stabbed in the woods, I was like, we have not really been introduced to that.
And they look the same, those guys.
Yeah. And there's, like, a bad version of him who's kind of, like, looks like he's wandered off the set of Game of Thrones with Vikings more so. And I was like, they look the fucking same. And then we've got...
I struggled with that on Game of Thrones in the season one. This white guys with beards. But yeah, I had a similar thing because, and again, going in with zero expectation, I think if I had watched the trailer, I did watch the trailer just now, just before we started chatting as a bit of a refresher. And I'm so glad I didn't watch it before because... Mm-hmm. I had no expectations, and I was quite engrossed in the beginning, and I was like, this is a pretty good opening to a Dracula film. I'm like, I get what this is laying down, and then I hit pause, go to the bathroom or something, and then I realized, oh, I'm over halfway through. This is going to be the whole movie. Like, this is, I thought we were just establishing, wow. And there are a few elements that I was kind of confused about too with the Batcave thing. When you say it like that, it sounds like Batman. But the vampire in the cave, because that's not how it goes, I don't think, in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the book or the movie, right? I don't think that's...
Bram Stoker's Dracula, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it very much is... Yeah, I think the Francis Ford Coppola one does get it. Like, it is just this thing of like he makes a pact with the devil almost. Just
kind of like, and so he
renounces God.
He's like the original vampire. That's the idea of it, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that kind of threw me too, because in this there's already a vampire in the cave. And so then I was thinking, so is he Dracula? And this is like a new spin on like what? But he wasn't. And then I rewatched the opening of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Sorry, I think I said Mary Shelley's before. And it was, he does that whole thing where he's like, oh, what kind of, I do all this to serve God, yada, yada, yada. And then he stabs the crucifix in the middle and all the blood, all that kind of shit. So, he's like the OG vampire and everything happens after. Like, he's the source of all vampires, theoretically. Not the first vampire story ever told, but within the story, that's what it's supposed to be. And so, that wasn't in this. And then similarly, I wasn't sure. You know, when you watch any vampire movie or zombie movie, it's always hard to tell. Well, it's important to know whether in this reality they've heard of zombies or vampires before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like in The Walking Dead, they call them walkers because in this reality, there's no such thing as a zombie movie or whatever. In this one, people seem to know how to kill a vampire. So, I mean, I guess it jives with what I just said, that I guess vampires did already exist and he's just happens to be a pretty good one. Like, I feel like that's a weird decision to make. It seems,
Well, we get that character, don't we? Like the monk played by Paul Kay, who is, what is very interesting about this film is like, who chooses to do accents. So he kind of like puts on this kind of like, yes, you've come to me. Like and he kind of like gives us the exposition dump where he's like, he pulls out all these weighty scrolls and like perfect drawings of the vampire and stuff like that. And it makes it out like it's a guarded secret that only like the kind of like the people in the,
that's right.
know about, like these monks in this monastery are aware of the legend of the vampire. But as you said, like, as the film goes on, all of a sudden it's like everybody knows, like oh, silver steaks. Like, we know exactly. Like,
yeah.
I'm surprised people weren't like throwing garlic at him at
yeah.
one point. Stuff like, because, yeah, it doesn't really set out how everybody knows the lore yeah. of. I even had to check. I was like, I thought silver was werewolf. Like, I was like, I had to like look back. Like, it's kind of like Googling, like, what are the rules of vampires? Is this following
exactly? Them? Because I was doubting myself again, not being an expert, but I was like, I'm pretty sure that's not. Is that a? It was a few things. I mean, none of this is necessarily bad because I don't mind watching something that I'm like trying to like, you know, process. That's kind of good, but I think the specific thing about not having, because they still, I feel like they still could have had him kill his wife earlier and have him, you know, have a similar thing to Gary Oldman in Bram Stoker's Dracula and make a deal with the devil kind of deal. It's bizarre.
Well, I've got a clip of Luke Evans talking about playing Vlad the Impaler. Let's have a listen okay. to what he has to say about it.
I think what we're trying to do in this film is to present him in all the different lights that he was seen in. You know, he was a warrior, he was a prince, he was a leader, he was a fighter, he was a family man. He had a family. He loved his wife. He also was a very fair ruler. And he was a man who stopped the Ottoman invasion of Europe. He stopped it dead in its tracks, which is a historical fact, you know, in this tiny little country, you know, he actually was the man and the army that stopped it.
So what do you make of the portrayal of Vlad the Impaler? Because I know, like, historically, like, from what I know, he was a bad dude, right?
Exactly. He left out the part where he impales people, because I'm not an expert on Vlad the Impaler. What am I an expert on, you may ask? Not vampires of Vlad the Impaler. But I didn't know he was a real guy. And then when I looked it up today, I was like, oh. And then I was like, wait, is Dracula always Vlad the Impaler? And he's not necessarily. So in Bram Stoker's Dracula, he was never explicitly him, but I guess was inspired by. Yeah. But so I looked up Vlad the Impaler.
Yeah.
I was looking it up today, the real guy, and that was kind of interesting. But, I mean, I guess in those days, is anyone truly good? I guess it's just what you did at the time. I mean, he seemed to take pleasure in the impaling, which is not a point in the good guy basket necessarily. But he's... I mean, you don't get a name like that for being a great bloke.
Well, they spend a lot of the time of this film telling us he's a really good guy. As it, yeah. like, but then there are just like, there are massive red flags. Like when he has that conversation with Charles Dance in the cave and he's like, he tries to explain away the way he does, like the way he does things, where it's like, the guy's a cold-blooded killer. When he's like, how does it feel to like murder all these? And he says, like, how many people have you killed? And he's like, hundreds. He's like, don't ever lie to me again. And then like, he's like, thousands. And he's like, how did you feel about it? And then he's like, I felt nothing. He's like, right, that answer right there proves he is a fucking psychopath.
Yeah.
The film portrays it like, but he loves his wife and son. It's like,
what? See,
play it more like that then.
Well, this is the thing too, because at the time when he said that, I was okay with it because I thought he was still going to become more of a bad guy. So I was kind of expecting this film to be an arc of starts as a good, like a Breaking Bad compressed into a movie. Like he starts as the good guy and ends up becoming the bad guy. And so with that, I'm like, oh, okay. So they're kind of showing that there are some like seeds of evil in there. And it's just going to, you know, get to the next level once it becomes a vampire. But you're right. They're trying to kind of have their cake and eat it too a bit. I think it would make more sense if it was more like just showing us that he has a code.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he says he felt nothing, someone that has a code would still feel something in killing those people, but it's like, but I had to do it. Like, I hated doing it, but I had to do it kind of thing. He didn't say that. He felt nothing. So it was bizarre.
You would have like got this idea that he would have been conflicted somewhat, because we get that back. Again, we get this backstory of like him being like this child soldier and is known as what? Like son of the dragon. He's got this kind of like cool armor and stuff like that. And it's like from the get go, it's like, this guy's a ruthless killer. Like, do you know what I mean? He's like, he's called like, and people relish in the fact of calling him Vlad the Impaler. And it's like, that isn't like, I don't know, like, if a friend of mine went, oh, I'll go down the pub, like, who are we meeting? Oh, Vlad the Impaler. I wouldn't be like, can't wait, like, what's he like? He's really good at pool. I'd be like, well,
did you say
just don't lose.
Vlad the Pale Ale? Yeah.
Pale Ale. Yeah, I love him. It's like, just don't let him lose at pool, because he will fucking, like, shove the pool cue in you and like impact you. Like, it's fucking, it's crazy. And like, I just didn't get this whole like superhero origin story of Dracula. It's like that,
and
there isn't.
I think that's where it falls down, because it is obviously trying to be that, which I think is just a huge mistake, because the first half, or even like first two thirds, it could still make it. It could still, like, this film could almost be a tragedy. Maybe he has to kill his, he ends up killing his wife because the thirst is too real for blood, you know? Like, something that is more, again, yeah, more conflicted. And it just kind of, especially the ending. I guess we're going to talk about that ending, aren't we? Mm-hmm. But especially the ending, where, which I believe was a reshoot. So I, in their defense, well, probably wasn't the director's or writer's choice to have that in there. But for anyone who hasn't seen it, the film ends and then they throw in another ending where it's in present day and Dracula's walking around a New York type looking city.
Mm-hmm,
and Charles Dance is also there, otherwise known as the vampire in the cave, who for whatever reason doesn't look so monstrous anymore, looking quite sharp. And it's like a post-credit scene before, but it's pre-credits essentially. One little nugget I realized though was so he runs into a woman that looks like his wife, and her name was the same name as Winona Ryder's character in Bram Stoker's Dracula. So I guess that was like an interesting callback, because in that movie she plays his wife that died as well, right? So it's I guess they're going a similar angle there. But at that point it feels like it's just present day superhero. There's thousands of years in between that I'm sure would have been pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's what I don't get. Yeah. It's almost like what, the game is afoot or something. Like, I know that's probably from Sherlock Holmes, but he kind of says that and it's like, he says in that cave, he's like, once you, like, if you become a vampire, you will unleash me from this cave and we will have this, like, battle and you will become my servant. It's like,
that's right. I missed that.
He's like, why has he left him for all that time? You know what I mean? It's like, this is...
So that explains why he's out of the cave. But, yeah, it doesn't explain why he's waited until the 2000s to make his move.
Yeah, I just don't, it doesn't make sense. Like, it kind of, it's bizarre.
And the other thing I just wish Dracula became bad, because the other angle I was thinking was, you know, when you're immortal and you live for thousands and thousands of years, human life might seem pretty trivial. So like, maybe you're not so evil, but you might just be of the same perspective that we would have with ants that you step on. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. It would be interesting to again, not knowing what this movie was going to be, I was expecting something where by the end of it, he's a bad, bad man. And it just mm-hmm. never came.
One of the things I was upset that it didn't set up, and it kind of definitely, and it that's the thing, instead of setting up this kind of weird vampire rivalry, if they had kind of like, I don't know, set up that like Van Helsing in some regard, do you know what I mean? Because it's like, yes, that is the more classic kind of battle instead of this kind of new thing of like, it's an old vampire who's left him for like years. Or if they'd like even just shoehorned it in and it turned out that Dominic Cooper's character was Sultan Van Helsing or so, do you know what I mean? Like, and then his descendant is like, you could have had Dominic Cooper be the descendant of the Van Helsing to come, like in the way that they set up Anthony Hopkins in Francis Ford Coppola's.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't care about this kind of
See, that would have been a better ending. That would have been a much better ending. You just see that same actor is obviously a descendant, I suppose. Yeah. The, I wasn't going to say, I lost it. what I was going to say. The Dark Universe thing, they are all doing the same thing where these are all supposed to be bad dudes. Like I guess Frankenstein's a bit more ambiguous. He's just dealt a shit hand. But the other, like The Mummy, which ends up being, you know, Tom Cruise jumping off things. Like he's a good guy. All these, they're trying to make these super best friends things with all these things that are classically villains. It just seems bizarre. That maybe some of them could be good, but making all of them like fundamentally good.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre. They're not the Avengers. Like, it's weird.
I guess it's that argument that a lot of people have with this kind of Disneyfication of like villains. Yeah. Like, you know, like we've seen it of like Maleficent and Cruella and stuff.
Cruella.
Like that,
it's like,
we'll give them a backstory and like make them. I don't know. Like, because with Cruella, it's like she does seem still like she's unhinged. It's like that thing of, you slightly understand why she is like she is, but at the same time you don't, like you still go, you're a bit fucking cuckoo. Whereas this is like, we're just gonna, we need to hang our hat on Luke Evans. So we need to make him like as likable as possible. Like that's not fun. And like, not to be like, it's not what they did in the book, but like, it is that thing of like, Francis Ford Coppola's film does it really interesting, as I kind of mentioned like near the start, is that like you can understand the way he is, like, and he's, as you said, he's it's more of a tragic character than it is of like, I don't know, there this film doesn't play in the gray areas. It is very like black and white.
Yes, exactly. He just stays like objectively good, like almost there's a couple of little. Because I haven't seen Cruella, but I imagine it's supposed to be canon, right? So she does, this film doesn't change the fact that she still becomes the Cruella we knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That kills puppies, right? Whereas this one, it's like, it's never, this is, he's never going to become the bad guy, which is just, again, sorry, I'm repeating myself, but it's just, at least with those other ones, that they're prequels that make you a little bit more sympathetic, but knowing that they're fundamentally doomed to become the bad guy, I don't necessarily think, I do think those films probably have tonal issues in making you feel, you know, Cruella, I haven't seen the movie, I've seen the trailers and it's all a bit quirky and, you know, but she kills puppies eventually, that's fucked up. And then you have the reverse of that, which no one else seems to care about except me, but with Loki, I don't know if you've watched Loki.
Yeah.
In the Marvel universe, fucking terrorist, man. Like, you know, Osama bin Laden killed a few thousand people in New York in 20 years ago. Loki killed like thousands upon thousands of New Yorkers. Thousands. And now he gets his own TV show where we're like, oh, let's follow him on his zany adventures. That's bizarre to me. How do you? So they've done the opposite, where they've started pure evil, but without even much character growth other than a few hugs with his brother. Like, he's just a good guy now? Like, how do you go from that to that? He killed people, so many people.
And the fact that the timeline of that show is supposed to be him at his most evil, because it's obviously like,
yeah, because never
from
he never,
2011, like when the first Avengers.
It's right after the attack.
Yeah.
he's just killed. You're right. That's a good point. I didn't even think of that. He's just killed all these. It's just happened. All the other stuff, like Thor 3 and all those things, hasn't happened yet. He's still pure evil. But then he meets Owen Wilson and he's like, oh, okay, I guess I'm a good guy now. So weird.
It is bizarre. So this film originally, probably a more fitting title was going to be called Dracula Year Zero. And it had Sam Worthington attached as the star.
How do you think that
would have turned out? Would you think it would have made it a better or a worse film?
I think worse. I like the title better, but Sam Worthington, God bless him. I think Luke Evans did a good job with what he had here. Sam Worthington, I don't know. He's a bit vanilla. I don't know if he could carry a movie, really. Unless he's painted blue. And the director was going to be Alex Proyas as well, another Aussie. What did he do? Gods of Egypt.
Yeah, I was going to say, this very much feels like his wheelhouse, right? Like
it does, right?
That kind of, I don't know, what else did he do? He did Gods of Egypt and did Knowing as well, the Nick Cage film. Like that kind of...
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen that. He did The Crow as well and Dark City. So he's done good stuff as well. And I tell you what, Gods of Egypt is a terrible film, but you'll have a good time. So I think, I think the writers of this film are the writers of a few Alex Proyas films. So I guess maybe that was the script. He must have been part of the creative process at one point, even though he never ended up directing it. The name makes a lot more sense. Year Zero.
The writers of this, it's a really interesting thing to bring up, because it kind of, they have very much created a niche for themselves in that, they wrote Dracula Untold, The Last Witch Hunter, which almost feels like it could have been put into this dark universe, or even it's basically Vin Diesel as Van Helsing, which sounds better on paper than it does in reality.
I don't know if it sounds good on anything.
As you mentioned, Gods of Egypt and Power Rangers from 2017.
Oh, yeah.
And they've also, they wrote Morbius, the Jared Leto starring Marvel property, I think it is, all about a kind of...
Yeah, I'm a little vague on that one. It's part of the Spider-Man world, so it's a Sony thing.
Yeah.
So it means it's not going to be as good.
And it's going to be, it's another vampire thing. So they kind of very much...
Oh, yeah, good point.
...have got a hard-on for this kind of fantasy world of vampires and witch hunters and stuff like that. Is there any points that we've kind of missed on this? Is there any moments or kind of aspects of it that feel like we need to talk about?
I do think aesthetically it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed watching it. I think the film overall benefited from me going in with low expectations, but also no knowledge of what to expect at all. Because I think I just generally think watching a movie with no context is often best, because you more actively watch. It's like an episode of Black Mirror. You don't even know what the premise is yet, and that's almost part of the fun. What is this even about? So I think that I always just tend to enjoy viewing experiences like that more. But then beyond that, it just looked good. And again, like I said, I was watching this not knowing that the Coppola connection was the cinematographer. So I wasn't even looking. I wasn't even looking for that. That wasn't like on my brain as make sure you're paying attention to the cinematography. But I was like, it looks fucking great. As ridiculous as a lot of it is, I still think it looks good. Like just that image of him climbing up to the cave,
yeah,
as unrealistic as that is, it looked fucking cool. All the stuff with you know, turning into a flock of bats and that kind of thing, again, as silly as it is, executed well. Like, it looked fucking cool, man. It looked cool. Yeah, I don't know if I have the vocabulary to break down exactly what was so good looking about it, but it looked good. It looked good.
There is a particular shot in this I really, really enjoyed, and it's during a fight sequence. We see a fight play out in the reflection of a sword that's kind of either been like impaled.
Yeah.
And I thought like that was like a really interesting way to like show us like the destruction. Yeah, just show us a fight going on. And I know like a lot of people, and I'm not sure if you've seen it yet, but the Suicide Squad, like that has a moment in it. You see a fight take place like in the reflection of Peacemaker's helmet, like the John Cena character.
Okay.
And people are going like, oh, has that ever been done before? And it's like, well, yeah, it kind of has.
Sure,
like,
has.
We got it in
no one saw it.
Dracula fucking Untold in 2014, guys.
Man, that's a good point, because on that scene exactly, I'm watching that and I'm comparing it in my brain to Bram Stoker's Dracula, Francis Ford Coppola one, and how that was all practical effects, all in-camera stuff, and that is obviously the exact opposite of all that. And that's the one thing I think you got to give credit where credit is due, that at least it wasn't in any way trying to do anything similar to that. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't – it had a point of view at least, and it had an aesthetic it was shooting for that was – it hadn't been done with this particular story before. It wasn't the 2000s, hey, it's Dracula, but now he's, you know.
He's in wraparound shades.
And yeah, exactly. You know, like none of that shit. So for all its faults, there's something about this movie that I do kind of respect.
Mm-hmm.
I had a good time. Like I wasn't bored. So yeah, it was just a lot. I don't want to say it's a good movie, but it was better than I was expecting.
Perfect.
And it, well, you know, sometimes we watch a lot of bad movies on our podcast, and sometimes it just hits you on the right day and you enjoy it. So it's probably also just one of those things where it was just what I needed that day.
Well, sometimes you need like a 2-3-star movie to kind of just like switch your brain off, kind of go like, it is what it is. It's definitely a bit of fun. Like it could have been so much worse, I reckon. Obviously, I feel like we've
probably, I don't know, like totally.
We've pointed out the flaws, but there are like, well, let's point out another one. I just want to play a clip of Dominic Cooper talking just to hear his accent.
Lord Impaler.
My oldest of friends.
I miss our days together.
What I miss from my time with you. The coffee.
It's true. My father's palace was a cruel place for a young boy far from home. But soon you talked like us, prayed like us, fought like us. Speaking of which, I am owed 1,000 boys.
Hey, one of the things I wanted to kind of mention about this, and I guess like it's a kind of biggie, is the fact that there is not a single like kind of person from the country they are supposed to be. Like, do you know what I mean? This is very much white British people. And there's a weird thing about Dominic Cooper that he is used to play like a lot of Eastern characters. Do you know what I mean? Like Middle Eastern characters, whether it was.
Really?
He's in that film, The Double, which is all about Saddam Hussein's son, who had like a kind of almost like real life stunt double who he'd kind of send out to. Do you know what I mean, like to create diversions so he could like do like get away from paparazzi and the army and stuff like that. And it's like,
yeah,
because it even looks like Dominic Cooper's character. There is a weird bit of like browning up for the role. Like, I think that's like one thing of this film where it's a bit eggy, right? It's a bit like, oh, what's going on with these accents?
There was a turning point where suddenly all that stuff just is so outdated, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Any kind of darkening of skin, it's just like a whole world of actors out there that have the exact skin you're looking for. Yes. Why do you need to get a white guy? But then the accent thing is such a pet peeve of mine. It's like I think the worst offender I've ever seen is Alexander, Oliver Stone. Alexander and Colin Farrell is Alexander with, I guess, the classic historical general English accent, I suppose. Mm. But Angelina Jolie, who plays his mother, she's like, she's so, it's a cartoony in her accent, which, whatever. I know they didn't have English accents either. My thing on it is just be consistent. Whatever it is, be consistent. We just did Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves on our podcast, and that is atrocious with the accents because even the same characters slip in and out. In the beginning of the film, I mean, I don't know if they shot it in chronological order, probably not, but in the beginning of the film, Robin Hood is sort of trying to do an English accent, and then by the end of it, he's just straight up American. It's insane. I hate it so much. It really takes me out of the movie every time it happens. It's just choose one.
I think the thing that really throws me off with this is the fact that, like, people who are supposed to be from the same place, is some of them are doing accents.
Yeah.
Like we get exactly. that monk who does the accent, and it's like, is this just supposed to be like, because he's a monk, he speaks like that, or like,
yeah,
because he's is he more Transylvanian than, and especially like when you get the backstory exactly. of Vlad the Impaler, where it's like he spent most of his life in Turkey, so like if anything, like he probably would have more of a, instead of we just get this kind of like angry Welshman, like a bit sexy and emo, like kind of like, I need to do what I need to do.
That clip you played, he literally says, "You talked like us." You know, this it's kind of he doesn't talk like you at all. It's crazy, and you're right. That is the chief offender in this scenario is when it's people from the same. So in Alexander, it was a mother and son, with a completely different accent. And in this case, people just because he's the more it suits his character more to sound a bit more exotic. I think actually, now that I think of it, the worst offender is Disney back in the day with films like Aladdin, where all the good people had American accents and all the baddies had slightly darker skin and that sort of classic generic foreign accent thing going on. Mm-hmm.
I think a film that really does it well is The Death of Stalin, in the fact that like they everyone do their own accents, because it's like, we're already making a pastiche about kind of like, do you know what I mean, like Russia? Like, so it's like, it's like, why not just let every, Steve Buscemi sounds like Steve Buscemi, is like Jason Isaacs sounds like Jason. Everyone sounds, and it's like, we're buying into the farce of it anyway. Like, if anything, if all those actors were doing, I speak like this, it would take you more out of it as opposed to going, oh, the dialogue, the story in the dialogue is good. I will let this pass. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, no, that's what that person actually sounds like. And it's like, it's that thing. If you're going to do a film where people are from another country, don't put on the sloppy accents. Like, go full hog.
Yeah.
Do it in that language, because in this film we get people speaking in Turkish, and it's only like, it's only for certain scenes and stuff like this. Yeah, it's bizarre. It's a whole other topic, right?
That's something you start to notice now, again, because we're always doing 80s and 90s movies, and in more modern movies, they do. I mean, it depends what it is. If the whole movie's set in another country, then they usually don't. But usually, nowadays, if it's a scene with a bunch of characters that are from another country, they will speak in their native tongue. Whereas in the 90s and in the 80s, they would still be speaking English, even though there's no English person there.
I think the big offender recently is Black Widow, where like you've got...
Actually, yes. I think that's where it came up.
Florence Pugh, Rachel Weisz, and David Harbour all like going, yes, so let's do what yeah. we need to do. And it's like, well, they're all Russian. Like, they're all Russian. They would clearly be speaking Russian.
Yeah. That might have been what triggered this. I think I might have read something on that recently. Because, yeah, that is 100% it. at least have some, just have more of it at least. It's funny.
Amazing. Well, let's get on to rating this film. And the unique way we do this on this podcast is by asking what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film?
So I think obvious reasons, it's got to be a red, dark, rich, Shiraz perhaps. And I was thinking, you know, maybe it's not a fancy wine. Yeah. It might be the one that's it's not the cheapest wine either.
It's not a goon sack per se.
Yeah, it's not a goon sack, but it might be the one that's on special. So you grab it. You wouldn't normally grab it, but it's on special, so you grab it.
Perfect.
The other angle I was actually thinking was I do think this is a good flight movie. I think on flights, you know, criteria for a good flight movie is, will I be bored? No, I don't think you'll be bored watching this. Does it matter if I fall asleep in the middle? Probably not. And is it just interesting enough? And so along those lines, I would say, whatever red wine you can get on the flight kind of works as a analogous for the film. It's just kind of there. I would probably never watch it again. But I wouldn't have a hard time recommending it to someone who is semi-interested in Dracula. Like, it's, why not?
Perfect. Well, yeah, I always ask, is it a top shelf, mid shelf, or bottom shelf wine, you say?
If I'm limited to three, I would say middle. I guess just because for all the reasons I said, this is not the best movie ever made. This is not even necessarily a good movie. But I think it at least has a take on the tale. And I think characters like Dracula or like Batman, there's room for all these different versions.
Yeah.
Because we all know it so well. So this is not the definitive version and it doesn't need to be. It's just another angle.
Yeah.
And a relatively worthy angle, except for the flaws we've pointed out, making him a good guy superhero fast forward to the 2000s. That's a huge mistake. If he ended up being a bad guy, I would say this may be close to the top shelf. I think I would go as far to say it is underrated.
Okay.
Only because it's rated so low.
Yeah.
I think its Rotten Tomatoes score is like 18% or something. I would say this is probably more like a closer to 50 maybe.
So it's got a
just seems really low.
6.3 on IMDb and 40% on Metacritic as well. So it's like kind of,
yeah,
25 Rotten Tomatoes. So, like, I'll be interested. I'll just quickly check what the audience score is, because that sometimes
is
a good barometer for what regular people think of this film. 58%. That seems a bit more like on level. Yeah. Would you? I mean, let's go. Yeah, it very much is in the 50s. It's like very much.
Yeah, it's in the 50s.
Take it or leave it. Like you're not gonna. If you're on your deathbed and somebody said, like, is there any films that you're, like, devastated you never saw? You're not going to be like, oh, Dracula Untold from 2014. Like, I wish I had more time.
Yeah. I feel like neither of us are ever going to speak about this film again, I'm sure.
No.
Never going to come up in conversation. But it's fine. It's fine. And there's some elements to it that are really good and there's some elements to it that are pretty shitty.
Yeah. I think a moment I kind of like took against, I don't know why, was when he's doing that kind of last airbender style stuff at the end where he's kind of like,
Yeah.
Summoning the bats and creating fists out of bats to take out these armies. And it's like, you could have done that.
Yeah.
Why didn't you do that earlier? Do you know what I mean? It's like...
And it can control the weather. So yeah. It can just always block out the sun so you have no Achilles heel anymore. And that stuff was in the trailer. So again, I think if I had seen the trailer, I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it as much.
I think
it would have tainted the whole thing.
For the use of like that kind of slowed down female singer version of Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears, my expectations for this film would have been rock bottom. I would have been like, no. I would have dreaded having to watch it. Yeah, the trailer does not service this film well. So before we get into the unanswerable, the impossible to answer questions, I always like to see if there's any Coppola connections between this film. So anyone who's in front of or behind the camera who's worked with a Coppola elsewhere in their career, did you manage to find any, Tristan?
I did not. But as we've established, I'm a little rusty on the old, on the Coppola family tree.
It's fine because this one was like very, very like I had to dig deep to find where the connections were. So there's an actor called Ronan Vibert who is also in Saving Mr. Banks, which John Schwartzman is the DOP and Jason Schwartzman plays one of the one of the musicians who wrote the music to Mary Poppins. Michael DeLuca, one of the producers on this film, also produced 50 Shades Darker, 50 Shades Free, Ghost Rider, Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance, Drive Angry, Simone, and Little Nicky, which respectively, John Schwartzman was the DOP on the first two. Obviously, Nicolas Cage stars in the Ghost Rider films and Drive Angry, and Simone, I think Jason Schwartzman's in it, and... Little Nicky stars, has Patricia Arquette in it. So yeah, that's another connection we have for this film.
That's interesting because this one, you said you had to dig deep for that. But then what you found is, if this is one where you had to dig deep for, it just goes to show you how beneficial it is to be in an influential family because you've got a foot in the door in every single one of those scenarios. You're an actor or a director or whatever the case may be. It's just kind of wild. Did you see there was a tweet recently that went viral for all the wrong reasons and it was Spielberg's daughter, Stephen King's son. Who else was it?
Sean Penn's son as well. And
one
other person, Nepotism the movie, right?
Yeah, basically. they're all getting together to make a movie, but it all was getting retweeted as Nepotism the movie. And it's just kind of crazy. Like how it's got to be hard to break into Hollywood if you're not. And you always hear, well, not always, but I often hear people I like. You eventually realize that they're the son of someone, whether or not they're the son of a famous actor. They're in the mix, and similar to those couple of connections you just made, there's just this web of influence that then you can just tap into. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's like that thing when you realize like Dakota Johnson, it's like, even some of they are like really obvious, or like, is it Lily Collins? Like, it's Phil Collins' daughter.
Yeah.
There's one, it's escaping me right now, but there's one like recently, and like, I was like, I think it might have been the guy who's in Captain America and the Winter Soldier, who kind of plays like the and it's Wyatt Russell, and it's like, oh, he's Goldie Hawn.
Oh, yeah, Kurt Russell.
And Kurt Russell's son. I was like, fucking hell. I was like, is there anyone in Hollywood who isn't related to
exactly
from like the previous generation? It's insane.
Exactly. And then there's even like, I don't know who, there's a bunch I'm forgetting, but one that comes to mind is Jonah Hill. I don't know who his parents are, but I feel like they're of significance in some way, shape or form. But it was also childhood friends with what's his name from Maroon 5, which just tells me that they're in these circles of famous people. Like, it's just, they're just not in our world. Like, you're already in the circle of influence in Hollywood.
Yeah, it's insane. That's, yeah, there's, I don't know. That, I think that's why I get behind somebody like a Stephen Graham, who's like a British actor who's like come from like relatively nothing. Do you know what I mean? A working class guy who is in like Snatch and stuff like that. And then like when you see him in like The Irishman alongside Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, it's like a real like, it's a win. It's a win for the small guys. Do you know what I mean?
I always, Greg and I always talk about on the podcast, like the ones that just come from unexpected places. Like the fact that Ray Romano is like a solid, serious actor now. It's just fucking awesome. he's in The Irishman as well. Like it's great. I love those stories. But yeah, they're few and far between. Unfortunately, when you start looking at Wikipedia pages and things, you realize, oh, everyone's got like Hollywood parents.
When their parents are highlighted blue on Wikipedia, you're like, okay, nepotism's at play.
Exactly.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, speaking of nepotism, let's get on to the impossible question. So the first one is,
yes,
which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the filmographies, the entire rest?
Is it controversial to say that I think this is an easy one for me? Because I just have to keep Cage.
How? That's perfect.
How? Because how could I not keep Cage? Obviously, you're sacrificing a few things there, and you know, a bit like Vlad the Impaler. You know, you want to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs. If it takes sacrificing the rest of the Coppola family to save Nick Cage, I'm going to do it. That's just how it is. Although maybe he wouldn't have a career without the family, as we've discussed.
Yeah. No. His filmography will stay intact by hook or crook.
Yeah, okay.
It will be that somebody else directed those films that Francis Ford Coppola directed. I don't know, Peter Bogdanovich or someone like that would have directed them instead. That's the way around it. And yeah, I love the fact that you've gone for a totally selfish answer. Those people who come on and sometimes say like, "Oh, for the like the wider scope of cinema as a whole," and it's like, no, I love it when people come on and go, "This is what I want. I want Nick Cage." So, fantastic answer. And
I've got to work within my field of expertise too. You know, I like Francis Ford Coppola, but I'm more of a Kubrick man. Mm-hmm. Like if Kubrick was a Coppola, I'd probably save him. But I just love Cage so much. I know I'm speaking to the choir here. He's just fucking great. I was saying to someone the other day, most people obviously know he's great. He makes a lot of shit movies, he makes a lot of great stuff too. But he does have this tarnished reputation because of all the shitty movies. But Bruce Willis, Robert De Niro, they make so many shitty movies. Yeah. And for whatever reason, none of it sticks. I don't get why Cage has so much, I don't know. There's always a bit of a smirk when you say you're a Cage fan.
Yeah, well, I always say that Bruce Willis deserves the shit that Nicolas Cage gets, because the stories you hear of Bruce Willis as well is he's not like...
He's kind of a jerk.
Yeah, he's not the coolest guy as well, whereas like all the stories you hear from Nick Cage is he turns up on set, he knows the script backwards and forwards, he has all these ideas for the character, he understands like the budget is low, so I'm just going to come, I'm going to act, bish, bash, bosh, like let's get it done.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fingers crossed, like this year, like, and then the next coming year, obviously, the kind of reaction we've already been seeing for Pig in the US, and obviously in the coming months it will be released worldwide, like that we're gonna get a new age of Cage. Like I think he's like gonna he's gonna ruffle some feathers, and it's gonna be interesting to see.
I am equally excited, but also perhaps cautious in equal measure, because I've been here before. Think, all right, Cage is back, baby, and then he's not quite. But
yeah.
But man, I hope so.
Yeah, I think he's quietly been doing some really interesting stuff and kind of like carving out a niche for himself in that. Like, Pig on paper, if you read that synopsis, sounds like it could be a terrible John Wick style knockoff. And it's like,
yeah,
something completely different entirely. So like,
that's cool.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen Mandy. I heard Mandy is something special.
Yeah.
That's one of those ones where I'm kind of saving it because I really want to be in the right zone for that one.
Yeah, I think you've got to be. It's a lot more of a heavier film than again, I think this is that thing.
Yeah.
Cage is just pigeonholed to being the guy who like goes batshit crazy on screen. Whereas like sometimes like the films I love it the most is when he does that and it's warranted. Do you know what I mean? Where it's like, oh
yes.
That's what the character would do in that scenario. Do you know what I mean? Like
yes.
Yeah, Mandy's a
100%
a prime example for that. There's like a moment in that, I won't spoil it for you, but like when he reacts in a kind of like mad way, it's like, oh yeah, if I was in that situation, like I'd probably be worse than that. Do you know what I mean? Like you kind of well, let's wrap this up with the final two questions. Based on this film alone, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
So literally based on this film alone?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Oh, I'm going to have to say no. I guess. how can I can't say yes to that. But, you know, he did a good job in terms of what he was in charge of. Speaking for the whole family, less so.
I had to change that question just because beforehand it was like, it felt unfair because there's so many of them to be like, are they the greatest?
Yeah.
It's like going like, I don't know. Oh yeah.
The biggest.
Yeah, they're the biggest. So like, I guess by numbers, do you know what I mean? It's like, I'd reckon you would win a fight with your family, would win a fight with that family. It's like, well, no, there's four of us. There's like 57 of them. Like they're going to beat the shit out of us.
Oh, I tell you what though, you made me think, while I am a Luke Evans fan and I think he did a decent job in this movie, I think Nick Cage would make a great Vlad the Impaler.
Yeah. Or some kind of like, imagine Nick Cage somewhere within the kind of dark universe, whether it is a Dracula or something like that. Like he's kind of, I think he's a massive fan of that kind of stuff as well. Like, if you watch
and he would be just, he would hit the right, he would be on the right level. He'd know exactly what this movie needs. He'd be a bit cartoony probably, as it should be. Oh man. Yeah.
So let's, this is probably the most important question of the podcast, which is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
You know, this is one of those ones, I don't want this to be a cop-out answer. But I like not knowing. Like I don't really have an answer. I just love when movies don't explain shit. I love an ambiguous ending. Not so ambiguous that it's like not confusing for the sake of being confusing or anything like that, but just not spelling everything out. That leaves you a bit like, oh, ooh, something to ponder.
Yeah.
And so you know, like, is Deckard a replicant or not? I know they've, now it's canon that he is, I suppose. But I like not knowing.
Yeah.
And yeah, in a similar way, I kind of just like not knowing what they said. And having said that, I was like, okay, come up with something though. I just couldn't really come up with anything. What's the best answer you've had to that?
Well, a lot of them are kind of like joke answers. Like a lot of people, I think a good recent one was like, I should have picked This Must Be the Place, Naive Melody, as my karaoke song. Like that was a,
That's good. Damn. Okay, I should have come up with something more clever.
Yeah. I guess what I thought of recently, like a joke one, was like, I've got a number for a lawyer just in case you ever need one. Which is I guess topical.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. Be wary of Mickey Mouse. That could be a good one as well.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, Tristan, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast. Where can people find you, everything you're doing with the fantastic Double Impact podcast?
So Double Impact podcast, you can find us on all the podcasting things, also on Instagram and Facebook, all under the same name. We're all about, we revisit movies from the 80s and 90s, basically movies we grew up with, and decide how they hold up through the harsh realities of a 2021 lens. 2020 sounds better, but 2021. We've got a few juicy eps coming up, we're about 130 episodes deep right now, so there's probably something you would like. I've also got a YouTube channel called The Pop Critic, mm-hmm. which I'll be honest is a bit of an experiment right now. So content is a little sporadic, but it's some video essays and some fun stuff, really. Mix of the two.
Perfect, man. Well, thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
No worries. This was a delight. An absolute delight.
Thank you once again to my fantastic guest, Tristan Burrell. Be sure to check out his amazing podcast, wherever you get your little bodies in your ears. And thank you so much to you guys for listening. And week in, week out, if you listen week in, week out, I bloody love you. If this is your first time, please be sure to dive into the previous episodes I've got. There's a lot of fun stuff and it's weird and varied, especially now that we're on this kind of Coppola bent of the podcast. It's going to some weird and wonderful places, and obviously if you know the Coppola family filmography, we've got some amazing places to go in the future. If you've got any suggestions of stuff that you've got a burning desire to see covered relatively soon, don't hesitate to get in touch, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com for the email, or you can catch me on all the socials, so that is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and even Letterboxd at Caged In Pod. As for next week on the podcast, we will be venturing back over to looking at a Nick Cage film. That is right, guys. This coming Friday, the 20th of August, sees the release of Michael Zarnowski's Pig. You may have seen the chatter from the American release that it's a career high. That may be true. And I will be joined by Andrew Pope to talk about this film. So do be sure to check out that one next Tuesday. Also be sure to check out Caged In Pigcast, where I've talked to people in front of and behind the camera, including producer Vanessa Block, actor David Nell, chef Christopher Zarnowski, and editor Brett W. Buckman. So remember, if you enjoyed this podcast, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. And as ever, I have been your host, Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world that is the Coppola family tree. So remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered.
Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drip Town Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.